AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 239 for April 25th, Tea Party, Ford style. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time or 2200 GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or by following the links on our website.
Very fast flash. Good to have you back in the studio.
Thanks, John. We missed you last week in New York. We got to talk about that, it was quite an event. And
we got to let everybody know Todd Lasas joined us too.
Good to be back, John.
Yeah, you were at Beijing.
I was in Beijing. I missed you in New York as well.
So we sort of went in opposite directions.
We
had quite an event last week. For those who haven't looked on YouTube or gone to the website or heard the podcast, it was a stellar lineup of people that we had on the show.
It was. You had some good stuff coming out of there.
And I argue that this is why Mark Fields was named or rumored to be named CEO after he appeared on the show last week. That's what I'm saying.
It was that performance.
It was the tipping point. You know, you sort of thought that was going to happen, and then after he was on AutoLine After Hours, they just said, you know,
this is our guy.
It was either him or give it to Stephen Colbert, right?
That's, yeah.
So, Todd, you saw there was some good stuff in New York, but there was a lot in Beijing. So that's the question. Has the center of gravity auto show-wise moved to Beijing?
Boy, I really think
China?
It has. I mean, let's say China, because like Frankfurt and Paris, for example, China alternates between Shanghai and Beijing, which is why the Shanghai Grand Prix was the same weekend, actually, as the press day at Beijing. It's usually a week after or a week before the Shanghai show. Beijing in even numbered years. Someone at Lincoln, or it might have been a Ford Motor Company executive, called it the biggest show in the world. And it's kind of hard to argue that, just in terms of, well, certainly in terms of the number of car manufacturers there. It's a bit spread out. It's not so spread out as Frankfurt, but there are different halls, and it's hard to find your way around the halls. And there was one point after the Ford press conference where they showed the new Escort for China only and the new Everest, which is a real truck SUV, that I walked through that hall and I took a right, and I was, Jeep on the left, and then a Land Rover, Range Rover, Land Rover Jaguar just ahead, and Jerry McGovern was starting a press conference there, and across from Land Rover, Range Rover, Mercedes-Benz, and I was in a crowd that stopped several times, just did not move.
Now, I've heard that they let the public in. You can buy tickets for media days, and it's just crazy.
Well, the thing is, first of all, it was such a pain to get media credentials relative to other auto shows, at least for us guys. And then to show up on press day, which was Easter Sunday, and you see kids running around, and there's families and so on. Yes, it was very crowded with obviously non-press, but just quite the crowd. And the halls are set up so that you have a combo of Western and Japanese and Korean automakers with the local companies, and
They got to showcase the local brand somehow, right?
Yeah, so it's not like Frankfurt where you kind of have
the Italians one area and the Germans.
Exactly. And a number of big, from a global perspective, big introductions there, including BMW, I forget what they call it exactly, luxury concept, which is basically a BMW 9 series. Taking it yet
Vision Luxury Concept,
Vision
I think.
Taking it yet one more
a Jinglish sort of name.
That's right.
Taking it yet one more step too far. I mean, it was a little bit over the top for a BMW. I think it has more presence than it has luxury car elegance, if you will. There was the Mercedes, and forgive me, I'm now blanking out on all the names, but basically the M-Class concept version of the Mercedes BMW X6 competitor.
Yeah.
That was there.
Which is sort of a crossover coupe.
A crossover coupe, yes.
Even though it's a four-door,
a four-door, but it's got the fast roof line, just like the BMW X6.
Looks pretty good, actually.
It looks pretty good, although I thought the front end looked rather massive. It looked massive for
the rear end looks crossover. Especially good, though.
The rear end, you had the deck-to-deck tail lamp, the horizontal
almost
tail lamp.
Almost
MKZ-ish. I would also,
MKX-ish to state.
MKX-ish.
I mean, I actually looked at the pictures of those two, put them side by side, and man, it's close.
One could recall the 1965 Buick Electra 225 had that same sort of tail lamp. But yes, the Lincoln MKX marks Lincoln was there and brought some journalists over, including myself. Marks Lincoln's entrance into China. That is, it will enter China this year, by fall with the MKZ and the MKC. The MKX was a lightly disguised production version. It was shown as a concept with no real door handles and concept car, only side view mirrors. But other than that, was pretty close to what we'll be able to buy, although they didn't show a full interior, didn't talk about powertrains. You can guess what the powertrains would be. It was a very nice design. I think it's a big step from the current MKX, and it had a longer looking hood. It had some nice flowing lines and looked fairly elegant. So that will enter the market next year in China and will replace the current MKX here early next year in the United States. So China is Lincoln's international play, if you will. They're not going to go into Europe, not anytime soon. But they're pretty open about the likelihood that just as with Buick several years ago, that China will probably become Lincoln's biggest market.
This raises the point, going beyond whether the show is going to be the new focus, but I mean whether the country is not the new focus. I mean, to your point about what Link was saying, Jim Farley, who runs Lincoln, said, "Success in China is key to our efforts to build Lincoln into a global luxury automotive brand. The needs of today's luxury auto customer in China have been fundamental to Lincoln brand rejuvenation globally." So you got Farley saying, "Hey, this is where it's at for Lincoln," right? Then you had Jeep announce that they're going to start building Jeeps in 2015 in China.
Yeah.
You had General Motors make an announcement of a big additional investment in China.
$12-13 billion. Was it
12 billion?
60 models.
It was 12 billion by 2017. Boost capacity by 65% by 2020. Ford showed the Escort there again, saying, here's a car that Mulally said maybe someday it'll come here. It'll be there first. Maybe it'll come here.
And by the way, Gary, Jeep was the first U.S. Manufacturer automaker in China, and after. When Daimler and Chrysler split up, Daimler kind of took that, and so it's just a return to China,
right?
And obviously they see that as being a huge play for them. Alan Mulally attended. He was at the Beijing show, and he was at a 50th anniversary party in Beijing for the Mustang the day before, kind of on what now certainly looks like his
farewell tour.
Yes, which of course will culminate with the launch of the 2015 Mustang this fall and the 2015 aluminum bodied F-150 this fall, and he will we can start a pool to see how many times he'll say in public the words laser focus, which he pretty much stuck to script in a roundtable interview I was part of there in Beijing.
So the question is, if we have, the domestic companies as well as the Europeans are doing a tremendous amount of work in China right now, is it going to be that China is where the car companies are going to make all their money, and that the United States and Europe will basically become
So far, no.
Secondary.
So far, no. And here's the issue, of course, is as a foreign automaker, you've got to get a joint venture partner, a 50-50 joint venture partner,
right,
or a 51-49, whatever. So half your profits go to them.
And you basically can't take the money out.
Very difficult to get the money out. And that's the other danger. You say, well, if we can't take the money out, then let's have all these engineers and designers and do work that we otherwise would have done in the U.S. or Europe. And we'll just transfer, you know, those designs that way. So there's a danger for the established automakers in becoming very successful in China to the detriment of their other operations.
Now, but what Lincoln is doing with this new effort is the first several models, 2014, the MKC and the MKZ, 2015, the MKX, and they'll add the Navigator next year, I believe. And then after that, the what they call the new large sedan, which is the MKS replacement. At least until that MKS, they will be importing Lincolns.
Yeah, but
from
they got to get away from that.
Well, and to get away from that, it's a requirement. They let it be known that what Ford needs to do is add another brand in China before it can expand anymore. So, like, just as General Motors has Wuling and Baojiang, and I think a third brand now, Ford will have to do that. And I would guess that Ford-badged Escort we saw last Sunday in Beijing may be the first to be rebadged as something else.
Why do you say they have to do the third?
Well, Ford said they have to do that. That's where from a regulatory point of view, right, they need to establish or buy a
Chinese-only brand.
Only brand, right. And that's the only way.
The government was starting to back away from that. The Chinese government was starting to. Maybe I'm wrong. If Ford is saying it has to, then I guess.
Well, here's what I think is happening. First of all, you have a lot of the local brands that are not gaining, that are losing market share and even losing sales as the Occidental brands, basically take over and do very well. And you could see this in the streets of Beijing. Obviously, we're looking left and right at all these cars everywhere, and there's plenty of traffic, and there's more than 20 million people in that town. There are 4 or 5 million people in each second or third tier town in China. So those brands aren't necessarily, you know, going along for the ride. So I think China's seeing this as a way to hook up an Occidental brand, a Western or a Japanese or a Korean brand, with a struggling local brand. And what the ones that won't get tied up like that may be pushed out of the way. If you remember the heavy equipment manufacturer that tried to buy Hummer, that was the Chinese government that basically quashed that deal, 4 or 5 years ago now. So I think that's kind of where we're heading. China certainly understands that they've got, you know, supposedly something like 200 brands, and they weren't all at that auto show, believe me, but, you know, there were a lot of brands there, and how do we have them go forward? Well, if they're 50-50 partners with the rest of the companies that want to get into into China, that's the way to do it. One other thing, Gary, talking about, you know, will these be profit centers, getting back to your point, is that Lincoln was heavily emphasizing the way China is taking a big chunk of the luxury market. Now, that's almost a separate question of the entire automotive market, and certainly, you know, Lincoln obviously has reason for saying that because they want to be perceived as a luxury brand, even though their models are just a little bit of a step up. I would call it more premium, a step up from the Ford Titaniums or even the Ford Vignalis that will be launching in Europe pretty soon. But, you know, there's lots of margin there, and there are a lot of luxury brands in China, and companies like Lincoln and certainly Cadillac, which, you know, only joined after Buick became successful, got into the business, are very important to those companies.
But to switch to New York and to sort of counter this whole luxury thing, that Chevy introduced the Trax. Where's the Trax available right now?
Canada.
And
China.
And China.
Yeah.
So although it will be built in North America, I mean, it is basically a Chinese vehicle that was designed in
Or was it Korean? Well,
I think that's Korean. The Buicks are being mailed. The Buick Encore is made in South Korea.
Right. But wasn't the Trax originally a Chinese vehicle?
I doubt it. I'd bet $1 million that's out of GM Korea.
importing them into...
Yeah, because that's the old Daewoo plant. Yeah, and then the Opel Mokka, it's all the same. Mm-hmm. Although I guess the Chevy is supposed to be decontented versus the Buick, allegedly. We'll see. So,
well, very interesting. All these different contrasts with the auto shows. And so you didn't get anything out of Mullally about when he's going to leave, huh? I'm sure everybody asked him that.
No, that was almost, I don't know if anybody asked him that, because that question, you know, that's been reported and it's brought up so many times. But he has said that 2014, he would keep the job through part of 2014. He hasn't committed to beyond that. And, yeah, I think it's probably his time to step down. I think, you know, again, when the Mustang and the F-150 launch, that's a great time for him to just kind of raise his arms and say, I've done it. What was the Boeing jet he worked on? Was that the 7? Was that the 777 or was that the Dreamliner?
He was
Dreamliner
involved. I'm not sure how much he was involved in the Dreamliner, but certainly all the way through the 777.
One of the things I should say about Lincoln is that I've got a piece at automobilemag.com. I'll do a little plug there, speculating based on some conversations that I think the new Lincoln large sedan, which will replace the MKS, will remain front-wheel drive as we know, and as we know, it'll go to that CD4 platform, which is a stretched fusion platform that will also serve the Taurus. But I think Lincoln is looking at a design that will have a rear-wheel drive style dash to axle, much the way the Audi A4 and A6 do.
I.e., not a lot of front overhang.
Not a lot of front overhang, but a lot of room between the rear of the front wheel and the front door cut. And so that it looks like a rear-wheel drive car. Obviously, those kind of proportions work better once you get close to 200 inches long, which is what the MKS is currently. Makes it look more luxurious. It's good for the footprint equation and the CAFE rules.
Because the bigger the footprint, the less you have to raise your fuel efficiency.
Precisely. And so I think they're going to do that. There were also rumors before I went to Beijing about Ford moving all MKS or MKS replacement production to China. And talking to a few people there, I got the sense that they're thinking about that. Now, Lincoln sold about 90,000 cars, 80 or 90,000 cars in the U.S. last year. It's not going to take that long, if they're successful, for China to become its largest market.
That'd be a good month. But let me ask you about this. So let's say that they come up with this car, this MKS replacement, mm-hmm. and it's a front drive car, but it looks like a rear drive car.
Yeah.
Now, it seems to be the accepted wisdom that if you're going to be a luxury builder, you need to have a rear drive platform. And if you don't have a rear drive platform, then there's something wrong with you. It's just intrinsically bad. So would you guys at Automobile Magazine be anything but highly scathing of them for doing something like that?
Well, I think we'd have to drive it before we were highly scathing. I think we would be skeptical, but I would also have to point out that Audi's done pretty well with front drive platforms.
Right. Mainly through Quattro.
That's
how they get the buy-in.
And obviously,
it's taken a long time to
get they already that. Offer all-wheel drive on the MKS, so it's not a stretch to think that they would do that. I still like a rear-wheel drive car. I like the fact that Cadillac has gotten back into that for the most part. But I would point to two brands. Audi and Volvo has shown three concepts, all basically the same concept with different style bodies, but that also have this rear-wheel drive dash to axle relationship, and Volvo is not going to go back to rear-wheel drive.
Right.
So in terms of
the credibility of the brand as being a premier luxury mark, I would
agree with you, Gary. I mean, I think, you know, you look at Mercedes and BMW and that, BMW is getting in the front drive with its one series sedans, and Mercedes already is with the CLA and with other models that are not sold in North America. And I think certainly, especially when you get to certain length, and then you look at what Cadillac did with the CTS and was able to get a lot of weight out of the car. Obviously, that's where front drive comes into play. One of the places it comes into play, but to have a north-south engine arrangement with the transmission behind and a drive shaft driving the rear wheels, and that Cadillac CTS is probably going to be lighter than, certainly most likely going to be lighter than a Lincoln competitor that would have all-wheel drive, just to make you forget that it's a front drive car. I think there's no question where our sympathies, if you will, might lie. I'm skeptical of that. On the other hand, I also don't see anything from Lincoln for years that I would consider sporty, a sports sedan, and I don't see them moving in that direction the way Cadillac did with the CTS V Sport, for example, or the ATS. I still think of them as being a little bit less of a luxury brand than Cadillac, and I don't think
they'd argue with you.
I think they probably would argue with me.
I think they would. I think
they would argue with me, yeah. But
then they'd go behind closed doors and say, Todd's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, I think they're looking at Audi while Cadillac is looking at BMW and Mercedes-Benz to a certain extent.
Yeah.
Well, so Dr. Botox, who often has interesting comments, says, if Lincoln had something as modern as the Kia K900 or Hyundai Equus, then we'd be rejoicing that, quote, Lincoln is back, but they don't and we aren't.
One of the cars I saw at Beijing was a stretched Equus, and it was on the Hyundai stand, so it was their own stretched limo version of the Equus. They're probably, for as few as they're selling here, they may be selling a lot of them out there.
Yeah,
and kind of foot massagers.
One quick thing before we get to our guest, David Liepelt. You had pointed this out, Gary. No new hybrids at the New York show.
No, but they had that Corvette convertible, 625 horsepower.
And there wasn't, Bentley had their plug-in, mm-hmm. I think, didn't...
There was a Range Rover hybrid that I didn't have time to look at because there was so much to look at. Audi might have had something.
Might have had, but there was no big green message out of Beijing either, was there?
Well, there was some of that from the Chinese manufacturers themselves. There were some different... oddballs.
Wasn't that Mercedes and BYD, didn't they come out with the their electric car?
And there was a JAC concept that I looked at that I think was supposed to be a hybrid or some sort of green car, but again it was a concept, so they didn't have to show an engine or anything. An all-electric brand there, for example, so mm-hmm.
I knew that electrics were not selling well in China, just as I would argue they're not selling well anywhere. But I was also very surprised to learn hybrids are going nowhere in China. They can't give the Prius away.
You look at the skies and you can see it's kind of like, yeah, we give up.
Yeah.
I mean, Beijing was, we finally saw the sun. I got there on Wednesday and we saw some sun, I think, on Saturday. It was very hazy most of the time. It's a very interesting country. The show was a good hour drive or so from central Beijing where we stayed, and we went through several toll booths in a bus, and just past the toll booths, you see these cars pulled off to the side. I mean, a line of a good 8 or 10 or 15 cars just off to the side, and one of our Chinese guides told us that these are people socializing. They pull over. They're waiting for. They're in caravans with families, and they're waiting for the rest of the family to catch up. They're just off on the side, sometimes double parked, and just past the toll booth, just sitting there talking to each other, or getting out of their cars and talking to each other. And the traffic was just so heavy that I don't think hybrids would help very much.
Very interesting.
Yeah, I thought it was funny. Speaking of that, so I got a news release from an outfit called Blue Air, the world's leading maker of premium indoor air cleaners. And so they sent out a news release saying how in the Volvo stand, they had several of their air purifiers during the Beijing show. So I mean, if indoor air quality is a concern, I just can't imagine what it is out there.
I would love to have the concession for the filters for that thing.
Yeah.
You would make a ton.
Well,
of
you know, Li Shufu, who's the head of Geely and owns Volvo, said that's how they want to market. That's how he wants to see them market Volvos in China. Hmm. That when you get in the car and close the door, you're breathing Nordic air. You're breathing pure Scandinavian air.
Mm-hmm. I think you're going to have to move a little further north for that. I met with Peter Horbury, by the way.
Oh, terrific.
And
yeah.
We'll have a piece on him somewhere in the future. And he's completely involved in Geely now.
Just Geely. Nothing Geely. To do with yeah. Volvo, yeah. Right. Yeah.
And he's
and running
he's,
the studio.
He's set up a studio because prior to that, Geely farmed out its design. It had contractors doing the designs. So what would happen, he told, I'll just give you a little preview, is that the contractors would submit the design. It would go to engineering, and they would say, well, we need to move this or that. We need to move the headlamps up. And they didn't go back to the contractors, to the design consultants. They just would have to make the change themselves. So, you know, that may
hence
explain.
Hence, Geely's looked as they did.
As they did. And I have to say, most of the Chinese designs, they're looking better. I attended one other Chinese auto show, the 2007 Shanghai show. And they look more competent, most of them. There
sure.
were still some odd
sure, because
cars.
They have the Peter Horburys working at them now.
I'm they
saying
do.
The guy from Cherry, what's his name, Canadian guy. So, I mean, that's how they're getting good design.
Yeah, and even, I mean, even the smaller companies, you know, basically what you'd have is something that would look like a generation or two old Hyundai Tucson if it was a small crossover, or usually a Toyota Corolla, sometimes a Honda Honda Civic. It was a compact. But I remember from Shanghai, I think it was BYD had this car that looked like a Mercedes in the front, a Peugeot in the back, and then it had the folding convertible top.
Well, but if you think about it, the aforementioned Daewoo sort of had designs like that, and so the Koreans have come a long way.
Certainly.
But speaking of designers, I should bring an update on Chris Svensson, who was here two weeks ago, right before the New York show. And as people remember, he said he was going to be driving his restored Mustang to New York, and that Maury Callum, the head of Ford Design, would be driving his restored Mustang to New York.
Just restored.
Both of those guys just restored. And I ran into Chris and Maury in the hotel. Chris's car made it. Maury's didn't make it 2 hours out. And I got to tell you, Chris looked shattered because you weren't here for this, but we had 3 inches of snow. And so when they left Dearborn, they left it in a snowstorm. And the snowstorm ended, and they got into a rainstorm. And remember he told us that he wanted the original tires on that car?
Right.
I think that was the biggest mistake he ever made in his life. He also said that he discovered that it took him 13 hours to drive there. He said he had to stop for gas every hour.
Ooh.
So, well, yeah, because they put a monster crate engine in there.
And he just was just beside himself.
That's I mean,
it was so, but he did make it. So just a little update on a former guest.
Look, we got to take a break. We got to get David Liepelt in here. So, Ben, let's give a shout out to our good friends at Firestone.
Introducing a car company that's never made a single car. We took the power of a 9-year-old V8 and gave it the impressive handling of Firestone's Destination tire. Now, moms agree. Every milk run feels like a victory lap. So whatever you drive, drive a Firestone.
Whether it's on television, online, or through social media, AutoLine knows how to effectively get your marketing message to the people you want to reach. Contact Stacy Eamon today.
Welcome to AutoLine After Hours.
Thank you very much.
And especially for having brought a Model T into the studio.
Driven a Model T to the studio?
Yes, absolutely.
I think you've got the vintage Mustangs beat by a long shot.
To each their own.
You didn't worry about putting snow tires on.
No, they actually do Model Ts do pretty well with snow.
Yeah,
really narrow tire.
Very narrow
right
tire.
Down to the bottom.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, and a lot of ground clearance, too.
Yep.
So we'll get into a whole bunch of stuff. What got you into Ts, though?
I'm third generation car crazy.
This car in particular?
Not this particular car. My grandfather, in 1952, purchased a 1911 Model T Ford. We still own it. It has always been owned by a resident of Madison, Connecticut. And anyway, Dad still runs that car. In 1953, Grandpa bought a 1915 Model T as a parts car. When my father just got out of high school, he restored the chassis for that. And then when I was a kid, he finished building the body. And so those are the two cars I grew up in, Dad's delivery truck and Grandpa's 1911 touring car.
So it's pretty awesome you drove this over here today. I mean, this car looks like it gets driven a lot. This is not, a trailer
queen
by any stretch.
No.
And what year is this car?
1915.
Yep. So. How often do you drive it?
As often as I can.
Now, I've heard that you even commute to work in this thing.
Yeah.
All right. So how far do you commute? And tell the audience where you work and what you do.
I work in Dearborn, Michigan. I work for the Henry Ford, maintaining steam
locomotives.
Yeah, the Henry Ford Museum, Greenfield Village, maintaining steam locomotives that run in Greenfield Village.
You know, when I was about 5 years old, that was my goal in life, to be an engineer on a steam locomotive. And I never got that chance, so I'm so jealous. That's got to be awesome working on machines like that.
It is.
How old are they?
The oldest one is 1873. Torch Lake was built by William Mason in Taunton, Massachusetts in 1873. There are only two William Mason locomotives left in existence. This particular engine ran in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan all its life in the Calumet and Hecla Railroad. So, and then we just got together in 1897, Baldwin, that was Henry Ford's personal locomotive. After he bought the DT&I Railroad in 22 and then sold it, he kept this locomotive as his own. And we finally got it back on the rails last year.
So what did he do with the locomotive? I mean, did he drive around?
Well, he had
his personal
passenger car, the Fairlane, business car.
It's like having a private jet these
days, exactly,
right?
Yeah. And, Henry was really enthusiastic about all kinds of machinery, all kinds of mechanical things.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got pictures of him running locomotives, pulling freight train. And, that's what he wanted to do that day. Well, okay. And he had a driver come and pick him up at some crossing, and he went back to Dearborn.
Mm-hmm. So what do you do with these locomotives? I mean, what specific kind of work do you do on them?
Well, I do all kinds of mechanical work, restoration work, repair work on them.
Now, the museum also has one of those gigantic locomotives.
Allegheny. Yep.
It's got to be the biggest steam locomotive ever built.
They actually weren't the biggest. They were the heaviest.
Okay.
The big boys were the largest.
Uh-huh.
But the Alleghenies were the heaviest.
Wouldn't you love to get that thing running?
It'd be a lot of work.
So how many locomotives exist like the locomotives that you're working on?
In total?
Yeah.
In the world? Oh, there are thousands.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. There are an awful lot of engines.
So,
yeah.
And these engines are on tracks and they're moving?
There are a lot
things
that are operational, yeah, certainly. Mm-hmm. As I said, mentioned the Torch Lake, that particular William Mason engine, it is the only remaining Mason bogie. It was the first articulated engine where the whole drive assembly swivels under the boiler.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty unique, but the 1898 Baldwin, that's a 440. There are quite a few of them around.
Mm-hmm.
So,
what does your interest and your knowledge of railroads tell you about what we should be doing or what we are doing now? That is, there's been a lot of talk and a big debate over high-speed rail in the U.S. and that, we can't afford it and it's just too big of a country and we've got airplanes, we've got jets anyway. What do you think about that as being part of the transportation equation? Do you have an opinion on that?
I certainly think it can be part of the equation. Of course, we have a kind of an odd situation here compared to the rest of the world. We just have so much space between population centers.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it works well up in the Northeast. Of course, there's been rail travel for all the way through the century.
Sure,
but,
sure.
You know, out here in the Midwest, it gets difficult and the cost of it is hard.
But, you know, one of the things I always like to point out, because a rail guy pointed this out to me years ago, we in the U.S. have chosen to move freight by rail. The rest of the world has chosen to move people by rail. And now maybe China's changed the equation, but up until recently, certainly, and maybe it's still the case, the United States moves more freight by rail than any other country in the world. Mm. We just don't move many people that way.
Yeah.
Sure. And, well, and but you John, and both of you, John and Gary, you know that you've been, I'm sure, on press trips either in Europe or in Asia where you've had a chance to ride some of the high-speed rail. And the irony is that some of the biggest car guys in this country who have done that are probably pretty enthusiastic about that idea, would like to see maybe a little bit more of that here.
Sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. No question about it. I for anything in a 500-mile radius, I would much rather take the train than an airplane.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, especially the hassle of airports and security and all that mess, you know, it's you don't deal with that when you go by train.
I'd love to take one of the New York to the New York Auto Show from here. I think that would be
it'll only take you 3 days.
Yeah,
high-speed rail.
I actually looked into going to New York by rail
for this. Chicago.
You have to go to Chicago, or you have to go to Toledo, and I mean, and literally, it is a 20-some hour trip from Detroit to get there. I mean,
I'm saying if we had high-speed rail, I would never. Yeah. I wouldn't take the train today, but
you're a car guy in addition to being a train guy.
Yes.
So how long have you owned this vehicle?
21 years now.
21 years?
Yeah. Good Friday of 1993.
To the day, you know.
Wow. And very recently then, 21 years.
Yes.
I also find this interesting that, you know, the commonly held wisdom is that car guys buy, we like to call them toys, but obviously this is daily transportation for you on some days, tend to buy the things that they grew up with or wanted to have when they were growing up. And obviously, you grew up with these cars.
Yeah,
but it's fairly unusual. I mean, the collector or the enthusiast crowd now tend to go for post-World War II cars and even later, certainly 60s, 70s, and even 80s these days. So, I mean, do you find you're kind of maybe one of the youngest guys at the Model T meet?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. For me, my passion really is, you know, technological development, and the first decade, especially for me, of the last century, so much happened. And, you know, from 1900 to 1910, the cars changed so much, and I have a 1912 Overland as well. It's a perfectly reasonable, drivable car. Enjoyable, plenty of power, no brakes.
Mm-hmm.
But other than that, it's really a fun car to drive, and, you know, just in a decade. So that's my interest in them, really. And I'm kind of odd because I really don't have a whole lot of interest in anything after 1930. But,
all right.
So those are your two collector cars, the Overland and the Model T?
No, I've got there's a lot more, yeah.
Can you name any of them?
I've got a 1930 Willis Knight 66B sedan, the Great Six sedan, that I've run over 25,000 miles in 3.5 years I've owned it.
Whoa, that gets driven a lot.
Yeah, nice. I've driven it to Santa Fe, New Mexico, Duluth, Minnesota, Waynesboro, Virginia, and 3 times to Hershey, Pennsylvania. So it's just a really fun, enjoyable car.
Now, Todd doesn't want us to mention this because it involves car and driver, and he's with the automobile. But you raced this car from Michigan to Long Island, New York, against Tesla Model S.
Yes, I did.
And that must have been a hoot to do.
It was an awful lot of fun.
And you guys took it pretty serious, it sounds like.
You
wanted to win.
We didn't take it quite as seriously as the Tesla team did. We had an awful lot of fun with it. But, yeah, we left the Paquette Avenue Ford plant on October 15th last year, and drove to Shoreham, New York, out about two-thirds of the way out Long Island, to Nikola Tesla's laboratory. And for us, it was 765 miles that we traveled in the Model T in 23 and a half hours, average of 32.8 miles an hour. Mm-hmm. We went 46 miles farther than the Tesla did. The Tesla's average was 32.3 miles an hour. But they got there first. So
by only about an hour, right? I think they were an hour or two ahead. By the way, when you say you didn't take it quite as seriously as the Tesla guys, let's point out that the guy running the Tesla team was Don Sherman, so of course not.
Yeah. He is pretty serious.
Yeah.
Yes.
But still, I mean, I was about to say, what an indictment of the Tesla. That's not really true. I mean, it's... Here's a car that's almost 100 years old.
Yes.
And over, how many miles did you say that was?
765 miles.
You're only an hour behind.
So what miles per gallon were you getting?
We didn't actually keep track of it. I wish we had.
What do you think?
I don't know. And normal running, the car gets about 20 miles to the gallon.
Mm-hmm. That's about normal.
I suspect we were probably running about 15, 16. Mm-hmm. We were pushing it pretty hard.
Because I've heard, you know, over the years, there's been all kinds of different estimates of what the Model T actually got for fuel economy. And yours isn't completely, you've got a...
It's not completely stock. I do have an aftermarket accessory carburetor that is on it. It was built in the early teens by Rayfield Company. Mm-hmm. And then I have a 2-speed Ruxtel rear axle in it that gives me, you know, I've got a little higher axle ratio.
Mm-hmm. But change the interior at all?
I just put a plain stretch vinyl over the original upholstery. It was blowing out in the road, and I didn't really want to put...
So the original upholstery was what? Was it leather of some sort? Or?
No, it was what they called enameled cloth. It was a predecessor to vinyl.
Really?
But the enamel has come off it mostly, so it really is just plain cotton.
All right, speaking of enamel, I got to ask you something. Sorry.
Yeah.
Okay, you got to debunk a myth here. That car's red. It's not black.
Well, it was painted red in 1958-59.
It originally was black?
It originally was black, yes.
And not all the early Model Ts were not all black.
No, yeah, exactly. From some point early in 1914 through the middle of 1926, all Model Ts were black.
So before?
Before that, the 1909s, there were different colors. Touring cars were red. The Roadsters, runabouts, were gray. And the coupes and landaulets, town cars, were green. 1910, they were all green. 1911 through 13, they were dark blue.
Black would dry faster? Wasn't that the reason?
There's all kinds of stories. I suspect cost probably, you know, the cost of pigment probably had an awful lot to do with it.
Mm-hmm. It's like buying it at Costco. He bought it in bulk.
Yeah.
So he had all that paint.
Well, and actually, it's really interesting when you get into the study of the paint on the Model Ts, because there were 13, 14 different blacks that were used, all different kinds of formulas, depending on where it was used in the car. Some were air dry, some were oven baked.
And of course, the T was built in different countries too, and I got to believe there was variation there as well.
And don't forget, the DuPonts were in bed with GM, so Ford probably didn't have quite the access to paint.
No.
So, are those wooden wheels?
Yes, they are.
And was that the full run of T's had wooden wheels, or did they?
Yeah, they came out with a wire spoke wheel. Actually, it was a welded wire spoke in the middle of 1926. But prior to that, they were all wood wheels.
And 27 was the end, right? So it was just like,
they're basically all wooden wheels. Yeah, pretty much.
And no front brakes.
No front brakes.
Which is very typical of cars before 1920. Did the T get front brakes at any point?
T never had front brakes. Ford didn't come out with front brakes until the Model A in 28.
And wow. So what's the nature of the rear brakes?
On the original setup, the foot brake operated a single band around a 7-inch drum in the oil of the transmission. And, of course, therefore, you were stopping through the differential. So if one wheel locked up, one wheel went forward, one wheel went backwards. Wasn't good. I have what they call a Rocky Mountain accessory brakes, larger brake drums and all on the back. And it helps. You've got about 7 seconds of good brake before they get hot and fade, and then you've got no brakes.
There's a great scene in the near the end of It Happened One Night with Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert. And he's trying to hitchhike, and she lifts up her skirt, and Model T stops, and you see the rear wheels just kind of juddering as the guy, you know, pulls it to a stop.
Yep.
So was this Rocky Mountain package, was that available?
It was aftermarket at the time. Yeah, there were all kinds of aftermarket accessories for the Model T. Yeah.
So that whole
Model T was like the original accessory car, wasn't it?
So SEMA early days was
absolutely
the Model T.
Absolutely. There were 4-wheel brakes actually available. I don't remember now the name of them. There was a 4-wheel mechanical pull rod assembly that went on the Model Ts.
But didn't the car have like three three pedals.
Yes, it does.
None of which are brakes.
Well, yeah, the right pedal is the brake. The left pedal is your forward gears.
Okay.
We call it the clutch pedal, but it isn't. All the way down is low gear. Halfway back is neutral. All the way back is high gear. You hold it halfway down in the neutral position. You push the center pedal for reverse. Your right pedal's the brake. But, of course, when you stop, you have to keep holding the left pedal halfway down so that you can stop.
So you have it in neutral, then you're braking the transmission.
Yeah.
So it isn't a brake pedal as we think of it in terms of...
Well,
it's actually putting the binder in the transmission itself.
Yeah, and it is a suggestion more than anything. You have to remember the Model T came out in October of 1908, and if you really think about the roads at the time, yes, there were asphalt and concrete roads in cities, but anything outside of a major city, it was a dirt road, and you know much of the country was just two-track mud. You know, mud tracks.
Mm-hmm.
And so you ran, what, 15 miles an hour, maybe 18? And, you know, the two-wheel brakes in the Model T, they work great at that speed.
Clearly, that pedal arrangement must have been the beginning of heel and toeing.
I was just going to say, there's no way you could heel and toe with that arrangement.
Well, no, your accelerator actually is on your hand.
Your hand, right.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Well, heel and handing, I don't know. But they all came with... cranks rather than electric start, right?
Yeah, the electric start was not available until 1919 as an option.
Oh, it was optional.
Yeah, and then it was optional until the middle of 1926.
Oh, okay.
Which seems kind of amazing when Cadillac had an electric starter in 12.
12, yeah.
You know,
so and who wouldn't have opted for that option? It was all about cost.
I don't
cost.
Know. It was all about cost. Yeah, in 1924, Model T runabout, the two-passenger roadster, was $240 without... the demountable wheels and without the electric starter.
So what would that
with
be?
Both of those, it came to like $420 or something.
What would that be in our dollars?
Or I figured it out. In 24, they were making $6 a day. And I sat down and figured out how many weeks. It was like 15 weeks of pay.
Less than today.
That was a new car. When you think about our pay today, you know, a week's worth of pay.
Yeah, I haven't seen
nowadays.
It in a while, but you know, typically average family, average car, you're talking 26 to 28 weeks of income.
Yeah, for a low end car. Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
I got a question for you. You ever run across Autoline oil?
No.
I got to show you a sign when we're done with the show here. There was actually a brand called Autoline that was motor oil specifically developed for the T.
Really?
Yes.
No, never seen it.
Yeah, I never knew about it at all, too. So we're going to have to make this a trivia quiz question on Autoline Daily.
But, so what fuel did you put in this car?
Whatever's cheapest at this point.
You know. So you'd run regular unleaded?
Regular unleaded, 87 octane, yeah.
And...
It's
a low compression engine. Tetraethyl lead was discovered in 1923 by Thomas Midgley, who worked for Charles Kettering at the Delco Labs. It really wasn't available until, you know, on a broad scale until the late 20s.
Mm-hmm.
There were very few cars that had a high compression engine that really was needed it. And it was really World War II and the airplanes in World War II where it really became popular. And they realized how high they could push compression. Then, of course, after the war, Oldsmobile, Cadillac with high compression engines. So
originally, wasn't this engine developed to basically run on almost anything?
Yeah.
I mean, anything combustible?
Yeah. It's got about a 4.5-to-1 compression ratio.
Mm-hmm.
I always remember when I was a kid, the mailman telling me how much he loved Model Ts, and what he liked is that you could set the points and the spark plug gap with a kitchen knife.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. That was your feeler gauge.
Yep.
You know?
Or a matchbook cover. Yeah. But
there's got to be all kinds of things that you can tell us about this car of how easy it is to work on, because that, of course, that's what Ford wanted, right? Henry wanted any farmer out in the field to be able to pull a wheel off and put a power takeoff unit on the back of it.
Well, yeah, and there was a lot of things that were available that way. The fuel system is gravity feed. You know, the tank is underneath the seat. And, you know, gravity feed fuel systems rarely mess up.
Just like the Honda Fit, exactly. We've gone back to that. Now, I always heard that if you had to go up a really steep, long hill in a T, you wanted to go up in reverse because otherwise the gravity feed of the fuel would get starved out.
If you had a, you know, low level of fuel in the tank, yes, that could happen. In the late teens, the Model T coupes had the gas tank actually in the trunk behind the driver's seat. So that was even more of a problem with them. The early Model T sedans in 1915, 16, the gas tank was under the back seat. And they actually made a longer intake manifold that hung the carburetor down much lower to help with that problem.
Unbelievable.
But,
I never knew that.
I have gotten on, I think I got only on one hill in my time with it. The thing stalled out and you had to back up. But there were other cars that it was more of a problem, actually.
So when you're rolling around, when you drove to the studio, mm-hmm. I mean, were people flabbergasted to see you driving in this car?
You know, some. You know,
just some?
Some are. Most just want you to get out of the way, you know.
So how fast does it go?
It runs real happy at 40 to 45.
Oh.
Don Sherman's testing and for Car and Driver, we proved that it had a level ground two-way average of 55 miles an hour top speed.
Still.
As this car is set
40,
up.
40 in that car has got to feel blinding fast.
Well, you sit way up high, so it's not doesn't feel quite
There's
as fast
no roof
as it does in a Corvette.
Windows. I mean, it's truly a convertible.
It is.
It's like driving a sport utility vehicle fast.
You know.
Yeah, except
Which
for the,
is why I don't like sport utility vehicles. So.
Except for the fact you're more likely to fall out of this thing.
You are.
Well, that's
you
true.
Are, yes.
That's true. But yes. you'll be clear of the wreck, so it's okay.
And I see you've got like Band-Aids on this thing. There's a strap over the radiator, and didn't come from the factory that
no,
way.
No, there's a ratchet strap over the radiator. The radiator is a reproduction. There's only one company that's making them, and unfortunately, they don't hold up very well.
And David, I know you drove on the unmentioned magazine story on the freeway. Do you drive it on the freeway regularly around town?
No.
Mostly on?
No. Never
on the freeway?
Yeah. Yeah. The speeds we hit on that race, I actually had never gotten the car up to. I never realized it could quite run that fast. You know, it you can't stop.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
On the run, we had a chase truck and, you know, an open car hauling trailer behind us.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a bit of a buffer, and we got on the highway only when we needed. Initially, we were hoping to stay completely off limited access roads, but anyway, as we realized how far the Tesla was getting along, we had to start cutting some corners.
If you have virtually no brakes, you probably want the buffer in front of you instead of behind you.
Yeah, well, but it's also hard for people to see you
That's
behind,
true.
And they aren't expecting you to be going slow.
And you're probably not going to catch too many of them, yeah.
No.
Does that have brake lights?
I have brake lights on.
But,
yeah. No, originally it just had a kerosene tail light. Yeah.
But
a kerosene
tail
light?
Yeah. Hand signals for turns, I would imagine.
Hand signals for turns, yep.
Yeah.
One of the greatest driving experiences I ever had was in a 1903 Curve Dash Olds.
Yes.
I got
mm.
to drive it 100 miles from Lansing, Michigan
okay.
to Dearborn. And the thing that floored me was the reaction to people and animals. So people would come running out of their house. We took all back roads.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And people would come running out of their houses with cameras and waving and taking pictures. Dogs would go berserk, barking, barking,
oh, yeah.
barking, barking,
yep.
barking. And horses would bolt and run as fast away from us as they could. And I couldn't understand what was going on here because there's other modern-day cars and you know, I understand why people are running out of their houses when you see a 1903 Curved Dash Olds coming down the road. But I was like, what's going on with the dogs and the horses? And all I could think of was, you know, the Curved Dash, you're even more exposed than you are in the Model T. So all they hear is this very strange noise, unlike any other car.
Yeah.
And two people who look like they're sort of floating down the road. And I'm wondering, do you get the same sort of reaction from dogs and horses?
Yeah. Yeah, and people driving their cars. They do the same thing, you know, waving and trying to take picture while they're driving.
And there's no bumper for the dog to chase, basically.
No. But there is something about the spoked wheels that you know, really intrigues dogs. They'll come out after them. Sometimes with not so good results. But,
Where do you get tires?
Coker Tire Company in Chattanooga, Tennessee, or Universal Tire in Elizabethtown, Pennsylvania.
So they continue to make these tires?
Yeah, really? Yep. They're not cheap.
Coker will make you anything, I think, won't they, basically?
They have just about anything. But
if they're not cheap, obviously it's...
But the original tires had tubes.
There are tubes in these. Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Oh,
yeah.
Really?
Yep. At this point... Dunlop makes their own. They have their own hand layup plant. But all the other high-pressure clincher tires that I know of are made in a plant in Vietnam, because all the hand layup tire work has gone over there for high-pressure tires. Yeah, which is kind of sad.
That in a million years. Yeah. Hey, look, we've got a number of questions here. We got to get to the rapid fire part of the program here. Ben, let's let it rip. Okay, David, here's a bunch of questions coming in from some of our audience here. Miradart wants to know, if you raise the compression, do you think it would hold together?
They do, to a point, yeah.
What is the compression ratio on?
About 4.5 to 1.
That's awful.
Yeah, yep.
And I was going to guess 7 or something.
No, there are aftermarket cylinder heads that are in the 6 to 1 range. I know my father's delivery truck, he got it up to 7.5 to 1 before it broke the crankshaft. And, that was all right.
AAH guest 290 wants to know, does yours have modern brakes?
Yes, I have the aftermarket Rocky Mountain brakes. Yes.
Oh, yeah, you were mentioning that earlier. I should have caught that. Let's see. What JM1NB wants to know, what major components are still original and what had to be replaced?
Well, all the major components themselves are original. It's running an original crankshaft and all. It is an original 15 engine. As I said, the rear axle is a Ruxtel conversion. It's early 20s when that came out. But, yeah, everything basically is as it was.
Early 20s.
Yeah. At least it's before 30. Real-world service intervals. How often do you have to do stuff to this?
The oiling system on it, there's no oil pump in it. It's just splash lubrication. There's no way to filter the oil. So we try to change oil every 500-700 miles. As far as chassis lubrication, there's an oil can under the back seat, and there's little oil cups on all the suspension points around the car. So in the morning, get your oil can out, you run around the car, you oil it. I did before I left today to come over here. That's just normal. It doesn't take but 3 minutes. That's all right.
That's great. So. We've got a phone question here. I don't think it's about the T, but Ben, let's bring in that phoner.
This is Clem Zarovsky at Delmont, Pennsylvania. My question is, the front end styling on a lot of these new cars, it looks like a Mack truck. Is this being done for the pedestrian impact rules that are being put on around the world? Some of these cars are really ugly with that flat vertical upright front end. I know it can't be good for aerodynamics for mileage. Thank you very much.
The answer is, if the car is sold in Europe, certainly if it's a European car or could be an American or Japanese car, a Korean car sold in Europe, you need the raised hood or some sort of device that
deflection device.
The key is that when you hit a pedestrian and their head slams against the hood, if the hood doesn't give, they'll get killed. The top of the hood will hit the top of the engine and their brain gets crushed, their skull gets crushed.
Yeah.
So that's why you've seen all the Europeans raise the hood. So you raise the gap between the hood and the engine. That gives them a lot more crush space. But stylists love these big grills, massive grills,
And I think a lot of it has to do with the continued fascination with crossover vehicles. That's the look they're trying to achieve.
And I mean, I don't think that's universal, because if you look at the new Chrysler 200, Fiat Chrysler has decided not to rebadge that as a Lancia for Europe. So the Chrysler 200 has a pretty low roof line.
It does.
Hood line.
Yeah. But I would say the look that the viewer does not like is not just pedestrian. It's also designers love these big grills.
He wouldn't like that Mercedes concept in Beijing, I'll tell you that.
Let's see, what else do we have here? Rivero Notario wrote in via Twitter. He says, when are the Chinese cars coming to the U.S.? And any guess which will go first?
Koros.
Because
they're selling fairly well in Europe right now.
Are they selling well? I didn't know how they're doing.
Yeah.
I would say Koros, and I spoke about Geely before with Peter Horbury leading design and with them moving forward and with the hookup with Volvo.
Would it come as a, do you think it would come as a Geely or would it come as a Volvo?
Oh, I think they're I think they're going to keep the design and the flavor of the brand separate. I don't think Geely would aspire to be a Volvo price range kind of car.
I'm just thinking in terms of you already have the dealership, the recognition. I mean, not that
Volvo guns
over here, but
we may get Volvos built in China, but designed as Volvos and designed by Volvo and, you know, engineered that way. But they're working on a joint platform, for example.
Right.
Not that bigger car platform that we saw in the concepts, but there is a platform that would underpin Volvo's and Geely's front drive platform, of course.
And then Volvo did just announce today that they've added 100,000 unit capability in their plant in Sweden, so there is hope that there will continue to be Swedish Volvos. So
yeah,
it's 300,000 units now.
Speaking of China, you know, we talked all about is the center of gravity moving there. Rivera Notario makes this great point. Chevy showed the new Cruze in Beijing, and they showed a mild facelift of the current car in New York.
Well, that's interesting. I haven't been able to chase this down yet. I was told prior to Beijing, and you know, I didn't have much time to talk to Chevy people there, that Beijing car, that the Chinese car is also a facelift. But the question is, you know, what it's certainly...
It's a bigger facelift than what they showed
in New York. And I have to say, on the streets of Beijing, I saw lots of Chevy Cruzes, the current model.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Wasn't the U.S. the last market in the world to get the Cruze?
If not the last.
Well, I think China was after the U.S., actually, because Chevy was just starting out in China at that point. And they had they were starting to take over some of the lower Buick models and rebadging those as Chevys. So I'm not sure. I could be wrong, but we certainly got it a year and a half after Europe got that car.
The other thing that I found very interesting is GM on its media site posted one shot of the Beijing Chevy.
Yeah.
Even if you go to the GM on their media site, you know, you can go to China, that portal. They had one shot. And here, Ben's got a picture of it up there right now. So... You know, we wanted to do a story. We didn't care about the facelift in New York, which was just a fascia. We wanted to go, here's the all-new sheet metal thing. They had one photo. And I think that shows GM sort of, they want to show the car, but they want to pretend for the rest of the media and the rest of the world that this isn't going on. Please don't show your American viewers this all-new Chevy that can only be bought in China.
Well,
For now, right.
Right. Yeah. I mean, and this gets back to my point. I mean, I just see more of that happening, that the tastes there will begin to drive what we have, you know, for good reason. I mean, if you're big volumes are over there, you design for your volume.
Well, you know, this is what's took me off all along is Americans have always liked big cars. Always. We've always been the country of big cars.
Mm-hmm.
And now I cannot stand listening to Buick say, well, we've got to lengthen the back seat room because that's what Chinese customers want. It's like, what the hell? You know, American customers want it. You just chop that leg room out of the car.
Well, we like the big cars, but we drive them. And the Chinese buyers who want that extra length are the people who buy the cars and sit in the back seat and have them chauffeur driven. So there's a little bit of a difference there, but you make a good point. Buick sold for a little while a rear wheel drive Park Avenue based on one of the Holdens, the big Holden.
Yeah, right.
I saw a few of them around Beijing. I have to say the car didn't look very good. It hasn't aged very well, and the design didn't look very compelling. I think Buick, for as well as done in China, I think they're bumping along trying to find their way. I think they kind of lost an opportunity, which they may be able to gain back, to be kind of a semi-premium brand in China. And I think that's the way it was perceived when they entered the Chinese market. And now that they've got Chevy on the lower end, but they're selling Cadillacs there too, they've got to be very careful with the way they handle the Buick brand there. And I think it's kind of gotten lost. Just my observation, what I've seen.
Very interesting observation.
Were Model T sold in China?
I really don't know. They were not built there.
Mm-hmm. They were.
I'm sure that they were brought in. They were some were assembled in Japan.
In Japan, there was an assembly plant. I don't know if they made T's there or just A's.
I think they built some T's at the very end of production.
And then I want to say Ford and GM both got kicked out of Japan 1936 or thereabouts.
Might have been. Yeah.
But yeah,
speaking of big American cars, how big is that car?
100-inch wheelbase.
Which is not that big.
I recall from seeing, from rereading the article today, I think it's 100-inch wheelbase and 133 inches overall length. If you look at
right about that.
If you look at the overhang, that's got to be right. So, I mean, that's shorter than a Mini Cooper.
Yeah.
Shorter than my old Honda CRX, which was, I think, 144, 46 inches long.
It's amazing.
Like
because of the ground clearance, yeah, I think especially, it looks way bigger than Mini Cooper.
It does. Yeah, for sure.
Just amazing.
Yep.
Let's see. Let's take another one here. MacDaddy121 says, do you think that the KERS or ERS system on F1 cars could make a transition to rally cars or Pikes Peak hill climb cars?
Not if you want good sound from them.
Well, you know, the brilliance of the KERS system is that's all electric assist, and that's just instant torque,
right.
You know, max instant torque.
Mm-hmm.
So I could see in a hill climb.
So getting it from braking and then
and
recovering the energy, then putting it out.
Right.
And McLaren points out the transfer of technology to its P1 supercar, the $1.15 million supercar that they sold 375 examples of. That has got basically what they say has got the old KERS system in the car, and I've driven it, and boy, it's fabulous.
Wow. Yeah. That's great. Look, time to wrap it up. We've got to let David get on the road here with his Model T and be able to get back home. But thanks so much for coming on, and especially for bringing your car.
Well, thank
with
you for having
this
me.
So cool. I love it when we have cars in the studio. This is my favorite so far. It's not just the look of the car, but, man, you can smell it. The other cars we come in, bring in here, you don't smell them at all. This car smells of, I don't know, history, oil, gasoline, and a bunch of other things.
It'll probably leave its mark behind when I leave.
That's okay. We'll treasure that. Todd, always good having you here, too.
Always good to be here, John. Thank you.
Cool. And Gary, let's do it again next week.
We'll see you next week there, John.
Okay. Want to thank everybody for having tuned in.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Your journey, our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 6 p.m. Eastern. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.